SCP-7600, 6 Feet Under, Part 2. It's sometimes said that hard work is its own reward, and while that's occasionally a nice sentiment to think about, it rarely works out in practice. People typically wish to see fruits for their labor, and while those fruits can come in a wide variety of forms, working for nothing is generally not too appealing. The Yeren, or Bigfoot, people of the underground city of Druv-Tul have been laboring for tens of thousands of years, practically non-stop, all in the hopes of completing an epic ritual to call their god back home. While we don't know yet what exactly will occur when the ritual is complete, I think it's safe to say that the Yeren aren't all going home happy for their efforts. Let's take a look. We pick things up where we left off, with O54 signing a death oath to help Metius and the Yeren with whatever it takes for them to complete the sundown ritual. Following approximately 36 hours of unrecorded activity, 4 returned to Site 01 via the usage of his teleportation totem, and after personnel confirmed that he was the real O54, he reported to the council what he had done during those hours. Afterwards, he pitched several plans that he had made alongside Metius, including the establishment of a Foundation embassy within Druv-Tul, the signing of the Shepherd Agreements, which would regulate the containment of SCP-1000 instances outside of Druv-Tul, and the Foundation's terms of engagement with the city, and the creation of an SCP-7600 research team. Lastly, the establishment of free information and material exchange between Foundation personnel and Druv-Tul citizens, to an extent limited by the Council, which would allow them to gain a better understanding of reality and allow the Yeren to more quickly finish the preparations for the sundown ritual. All of these proposals were tentatively agreed upon, and over the next couple of months, they would become integrated into the Foundation procedure regarding Druv-Tul. We're next given some audio logs recorded by O54 as part of his research on SCP-7600, as well as a handful of sketches drawn by him, detailing the Yeren and other creatures found in the region. In the first log, 4 says that today was the first day he's felt alive since he was born. He doesn't often like to use dramatic language, but it's hard to talk about Druv-Tul and everything surrounding it without reeking of excitement. Walking among these ageless halls feels like the fulfillment of everything he has ever dreamt of. From scrolls as ancient as time itself, to people almost living beyond time, to answers to secrets he thought he'd never hear. He compares it to some pure, dreamlike ecstasy, and says that he never wants to wake up. The best thing, however, is that 058 agrees, and for once he's happy that she sees his decision as a positive one, with them currently working together to decipher everything. Yesterday, he spent his days working on things he couldn't care about any less, filing papers and sending out orders he knew didn't matter. But today, he lives once more, freed from the shackles of bureaucracy and oversight. Tomorrow, he will answer every lingering question he's had in his mind since he was a young scholar. And all of this, all of these incredible, unbelievable, nearly incomprehensible opportunities were given to him by pure chance. He does not know if there's any god up there, but he supposes he should be thankful to them just in case. He's yet to explore more nuanced parts of 7600, as 8 and him do not want to indulge in specific research without his trusted men who are yet to arrive. For now, as little as simply taking steps within the city is more than enough for his hungry mind. From the brief talks he could get Metius to have with him, he's gleaned more answers than he's ever been given from reading books older than most civilizations. 100 years of reading, trumped by fleeting conversation. He cannot put into words how excited, satisfied, and intrigued he is. 058 rolls her eyes, but admits that neither can she. Tomorrow, their work truly begins, and he doesn't think it would be fair to keep it waiting. 12 days later, Four says that it might sound silly for a man like him to say this, but out of all of the ever-present reminders of the universe's indifference towards us, for this to be what finally breaks him probably sounds like a joke. He couldn't be more serious, however, and to an extent, slightly terrified of the might the key holds within its walls. When they first arrived here, he didn't feel that, and it was only when he and his men started to map out the palace and the inner sanctum 2 days ago that it truly hit. This never-ending weight and realization of the age of everything, from Druv Tul to the stars its citizens envy, just pours upon you when you try to comprehend it. He can see it in his men as well, but he also sees that, like him, they don't want it to stop. The palace is beautiful, with magic interweaved with techniques he thought were lost to time. They began to reverse engineer them, but this incredible mixture of technology and biomancy is truly alien in some ways and yet familiar in others. Their solutions to problems they thought to be impassable are so beautiful in their natural simplicity, and their continued, unfailing operation is so precise and trustworthy in its every turn. So far, they could only understand 2 recovered pieces, but there's still so much they just do not know. Even with as little as these, they were capable of automating and enhancing processes they previously couldn't hope to even reliably utilize. There's still so much more they can do, however, and 8 chimes in to say that, more importantly, there's so much more they will do. Another 12 days later, Four says that it's hard to talk about the stars down here without his hands trembling. You'd think that for such a common phenomenon, something he sees every night as he goes to sleep, that it would be stupid for it to make him shiver, but he simply cannot truly explain it. Not without showing what the sky looks like here. To even call it a sky is a disservice, as it's a meticulously crafted piece of artwork hung above the ground for everyone to see and remind themselves why they work each and every day, to get even a step closer to them. Even to someone as culturally distant from the people of 7600 as himself, he can guarantee that it does its job well. However, the cosmos here isn't just a display of power, magic, and goals. It's a chronicle. From what he was able to gather from the people of Druv Tul and his own observations, the stars do not depict the current night sky. Rather, they're an image of an age long ago, as they were made to mirror the stars as remembered by those who ran during the Day of the Flowers, from their memories of the night before. He's yet to send photos and observations of them over to the Department of Astrophysics, but he's more than certain that they will find them as fascinating and, hopefully, useful as he has. With each day, the stars seem to grow closer, all while the people of 7600 approach the final day of their preparations for the ritual. They're less than a month away now, Metius says, and practically everyone is doing anything they can to help. They're within an arm's reach of a revolution that will change the world forever, and 8 says that, hopefully, it will change for the better. Another couple of weeks later, 4 says that he was finally able to talk to Metius today, after more than a month of preparations and trying to maneuver between royal duties. It was everything and more than what he could have asked for. For 24 hours, he bothered him with questions troubling him since 1870, and got so many answers. He was reckless with some of them, but curious with even more, and that curiosity was as satisfied as it could possibly be. He gave him every solution he was aware of, with some, of course, he didn't have yet due to the ritual and Fomet not yet arriving. But for every question Four asked that he could answer, he answered tenfold. For a select few of his braver inquiries, however, he had strange replies. He wanted to know what Metius's people meant when they greeted him with their chants, reminding them of the massacre they allowed to happen to the Fae. To that, he simply stated that it's a cruel world out there, and he grieves the loss of old brethren. But the sad truth is, the fewer enemies out there, the better. He can't expect Mab's children to be anything but that, and he simply wanted to congratulate them on so easily getting rid of a parasite he thought to be immovable. 8 remarks that it's not good, but the death oath is still active, so she doubts that it's much to worry about. 4 says that the majority of their time went much more smoothly than that. They discussed their long-gone empire, to the Day of the Flowers, to even their involvement with human history, and he can't wait to see the look on Judith's face when she realizes that he was right about the fact that the Mechanites couldn't have built the first war colossi on their own. He guesses that she was right about the Deva magic, though. He says that it was not only eye-opening, but in a sense it was soul-opening too. 8 then clears her throat, asking to talk to him off the record, as she knows how passionate he is about this, but she's been worried for him. The rest of that log has been redacted due to the O5 Council Identity Protection Protocol. 2 weeks later, 4 records another log, this time without 8 present. He states that he nearly died today, but he doesn't regret it. It was terrifying, and perhaps also stupid, but he would not say his near-demise experience was a waste of time. After thoroughly investigating the 4 upmost rings of Druv Tul, today is the day that he and his men would finally venture into the 5th, after all the proper preparation was complete. For better or worse, they found their way into the most industrial, factory-filled area he'd ever seen, and for the next few hours, they split up and explored where they could. As for himself, he took responsibility to thoroughly probe an industrial building up close. Having found a place he'd like to enter, he went through its massive doors and simply observed what transpired inside. Some deep part of him was simply struck and shocked by just how much these people cared for what they do, as even when uncomfortable or tired, they do not so much as complain. They continue on in their seemingly endless toil, sacrificing blood, sweat, and tears for their sacred goal. He has nothing but the utmost respect for that, and so, intrigued to learn more, he went a bit further and got a little too close. As he approached one of the workers, the floor simply disappeared beneath his feet, causing him to plunge right into a pit of magma the men used for their work. Even from within his protective bubble, he could feel the heat as it choked the orb tighter and tighter, eventually starting to suffocate him. Thankfully, the Yaren acted quickly, pulling him out with a few rituals of their own. In reality, he was out in mere seconds, but the threat was real and terrifying. Beyond the fear, though, there was excitement, as he had finally been free of the bounds of that sterile palace and Metius's guard, stepping into the real world. Truth be told, it almost feels as if Metius is trying to separate himself from his people. He'll go back tomorrow to see more of the inside of the factory and the pure efficiency it holds. This time, though, he can guarantee himself to not be such a fool again. Before this incident, the O5 Council had tolerated, albeit tentatively, the doings of O5 4 and 8 within 7600, despite their frequent danger and lack of professionalism. But this incident prompted 8 to declare a security intervention a necessity. She called a non-emergency O5 council meeting, ordering 4's immediate attendance. As 4 enters, The other five attending council members look at him with visible disapproval and disappointment. The least satisfied of these is 058, who has her hands folded and her chin propped up against them, looking at 4 with near anger. 4 ignores them, correcting his stack of documents and journals before taking a seat and asking what this is all about. 8 furrows her brow and stands, telling him that he nearly died out there, and angrily asking what he thinks they called him for. 4 sighs and bites his lip, but as he begins to go into his argument, 8 stops him, telling him that he's being put down, as they cannot lose him. He is officially removed from the 7600 project, and he will not be allowed back into Druv Tool until he can prove himself capable of not getting himself killed. She and the project cannot afford such a loss. 4 scoffs in response, calling this absurd, but she replies that the only absurd thing here is him nearly dying in a factory, surviving only by sheer dumb luck. He again tries to explain, but she tells him that she's not going to repeat herself, and begs him to just comply, or she'll take over the project forever, as he's not allowed to die. 4 punches the table and stands, yelling at her to listen to him for once. He apologizes to 051, but says that the last time he checked, they all have equal voices on the council. 8 angrily looks over to 1, but he just motions for both of them to sit, and quietly says that 4 at least deserves to be heard out. 4 thanks him, and says that he won't try to defend his reckless behavior, as it was irresponsible and plainly stupid for someone of his station. Removing him from the 7600 project, however, would be a monumental waste of potential. They are nearing the end of their work, and he, 8, and his team have been relentlessly studying everything they can gather from inside the city. In just 2 days, they will finally be done, and the sundown ritual will be finished, allowing them to solve the puzzle they've been piecing together for the last few months. He tells him to think about what they could do with a complete and absolute history of their relations with the Yaren and the Fae. 057 interrupts him, asking if they're really just going to ignore the fact that he's been aiding an anomaly in the creation of a ritual that would most likely summon an equally powerful god in the process. 4 replies that Fomet is no god, and he's documented this heavily in the reports he sent them, but it seems like they've forgotten to check their mail. He's no threat, and he never was. The council members look amongst themselves, confused, before pulling out their tablets to look at the information. While they're at it, let's take a look at an excerpt from the document ourselves, which reads, "By far the strangest belief shared by the people of SCP-7600, including Metius himself, is that this Fomet is a god. Perhaps this is due to the near quarter of a million years that have passed since the dreaded Day of the Flowers, or maybe due to some magic machinations Fomet himself cast upon his people. But the belief is, well, simply wrong. There's just too much proof as to the contrary. From ancient tablets recovered from the ruins below the Inner Sanctum, to simply piecing together stories told of him, I'm honestly baffled at how nobody in over 200,000 years has ever pieced it together before us. Perhaps this is some sort of ion situation, where the truth got bent through time to reflect some propaganda or artificial faith, some semiohazard or who knows what else, but there is one thing I'm certain of. The sundown ritual poses no threat. I've studied the runes that compose it extensively, and from what I could gather, it is simply designed to shine a light so bright from the gigantic lanterns that its light will pierce the natural barriers of our reality, bursting into the myriad of worlds outside of it. And it is designed to only catch Fomet's eye, so the chance of any other being, such as Mab, becoming aware of the beacon is a non-concern. I have played with the idea of sharing this truth with the people of SCP-7600 extensively, but I simply do not have the heart to tell them this. I think it will be best if they realize it themselves, for both themselves and us. After reading through it, 8 says that it ultimately doesn't change much, as he's still actively exposing himself to a truly unknowable force that could, if it so chose to, level the entirety of Earth with the ritual it has brewing down there. The fact that it hasn't done so already doesn't mean that they can't do it to him. 4 can't believe that she says it doesn't change anything, as it changes everything. He looks to the rest of the council, asking where their passion has gone, and if it's been hidden entirely behind their paranoia and foolish worries. He asks where the people are that sat down with him in 1870, seething with incredible excitement, in anticipation to understand this magical world they live in. Have they really become so stuck up in their bureaucracy and their fetish of power that they forgot why they formed this group in the first place? This might finally allow them to defeat the Queen sitting below this meeting room, and he's just trying to piece together a mystery that they all promised to solve together. 057 growls at him and asks if he's done, as she didn't come here to be insulted, not by him or by the witch he calls his sister. If he has anything of actual substance to say, he knows where to find her, but dealing with the head of the GOC right now is a little more important than whatever theater show he's putting on here. She then stands from her seat, waving her hand with a fake smile before shifting it to a grimace as she leaves the room. Eventually, 4 speaks again, stating that he's going too. And if they want to prove him wrong about what he said earlier, and witness what will most likely be the single most spectacular magic ritual to ever occur, they also know where to find him. To 8, he hopes that she will one day see how much she breaks their mother's heart every day, because she taught them to live a life of wonder, not one where they're so afraid they won't even take risks. Following the conclusion of the meeting, 4 once again resumed his operations within 7600, while 8 entered Foundation-controlled parts of the city without informing him. No party previously involved in 4's attempted reprimand protested in any capacity. Approximately 2 hours after the meeting, a recording was sent to all Council and MTF Alpha 1 members from 054's account, marked with Level 0 Priority. Despite being registered as sent by the database, the recipients only received it sometime later, with the reason for this being unknown. The recording begins by showing a gigantic underground valley extending in every direction, with a river of magma slowly flowing through the middle. Despite its location, the entire area is brightly lit, both by the flowing magma and artificial thaumaturgic lights above, although the latter are mostly shrouded by the ever-present smoke and dust. In the far distance, parts of industrial buildings can be seen, with the rest of the structures hidden behind mountains of black stone and smog. Despite this, a few Yaren workers are present, and 4 waves to them. From the context of the surroundings, it can be deduced that the recording depicts one of Druv'Thul's lower rings. The camera slowly moves away as 4's tired sigh can be heard, and his walk continues for a few more minutes before he settles near a large opening, almost entirely devoid of any of the previously described buildings. He looks over the horizon and pulls out one of his journals alongside a pen, sighing again before starting to draw or note down something. It appears that he's illustrating the landscape and marking notes, with this continuing for a moment before he remarks out loud that if only the others could see the city's beauty the way that he does. He then shuts the book and slowly sits on the ground, massaging his temples and slowly breathing. He looks to the horizon, admiring the view as the sound of clinging metal and glowing magic is heard in the distance. Eventually, he stands and starts to walk again, heading towards a large tunnel situated inside one of the mountains before him. As he continues, step after step, his sight turns towards the pavement below, crafted from black cobblestone and bricks. It's the only even surface among the rough patches of stone making up the hills it cuts through, and within its structures, a series of barely visible, interconnected thaumaturgic circles are woven throughout, covering the entire sidewalk. Everywhere he looks, one symbol is seen, forming one gigantic circle over the entirety of the ring, which later connects to the remaining sites throughout the rest of Druv'tul, creating a single, monumental ritual site over the city's entire space. The pieces he currently observes, however, are not so large, all symmetrical and mostly consist of identical round symbols with a diameter of approximately 75 centimeters. One pattern that takes up a significant portion of the pathway catches Four's attention, though. He squints his eyes and focuses solely on it for a few moments, accidentally tripping over some irregularity in the path in the process. He tries to prop himself up with his hand, but the unknown symbols start to rapidly glow, forming a chain reaction that circles him. He turns, realizing one of his pockets is similarly glowing, pulling out the Site-01 teleportation totem. As he does so, the circle below his arm starts to glow much more aggressively, and his arm begins to turn gray. He screams and stands up, with visible difficulty, seeing that his arm has withered significantly. Upon breaking contact, the energy within the circles below spreads out into very dim light until it vanishes altogether. Around him, various workers start to approach him, worry in their eyes, but he motions to them to stay back. He looks around frantically, trying to see how many more of these circles surround him, and it's revealed that they stretch almost everywhere, woven into almost every dormant incantation of the thaumaturgic structure 7600 holds within itself. His breathing grows irregular as he picks up the teleportation totem and smashes it, but nothing happens. His eyes widen as his heartbeat surpasses standard rates, and he turns toward the Yeren. They exchange a few inaudible words before Four starts to run towards the inner sanctum tunnel, tapping something on his Foundation phone. The remaining Yeren look frantically at each other and rapidly depart, as Four repeatedly swears. His phone tapping gets more aggressive, apparently due to no response, and he picks up his pace. His vision is now entirely focused on the destination in front of him, and his expression turns from fear into one of determination and anger. As he crosses the anti-thaumaturgic border that separates the inner sanctum, the feed gets forcefully disconnected. The follow-up video feed is quite corrupted from the extreme amount of thaumaturgic backlash caused by the sundown ritual, so whether the events it depicts are fully true is currently unknown. As Four enters the inner sanctum, he taps his phone a few times, rebooting it once more, and sees that Metius's palace is noticeably glowing. All thaumaturgic symbols covering its walls and paths leading to it are now brightly lit, and a vague beacon of white illumination extends into the sky above, terminating near the ceiling, which it appears to be slowly excavating. Around the palace, a myriad of Yeren can be seen actively trying to breach the border between the inner sanctum and the lower rings, with many of them succeeding and pouring into the palace. Four picks up his pace, entering the building and continuing to run until he makes his way into corridors crowded by protesters. He pushes through until reaching the throne room, panting from exhaustion, and he goes behind the throne to the glass wall, replicating the order in which Metius tapped it previously. The balcony opens up, and Four steps forward, embracing the blinding light of the outside world. Once he is able to properly see again, he notices Metius standing towards the edge of the balcony, looking into the horizon towards the myriad statues decorating the banks of the lake. Their lights are starting to dimly glow, pulsating with a similar tone as the beacon erupting from the palace. As Four steps out across the balcony, the king takes notice of him, smiling widely as he extends his arms, saying how glad he is to see him. Four interrupts him, shouting that he's a liar and angrily approaching him. He states that Metius lied to him after everything he did for him. Metius's expression shifts from happiness to a grimace, and he turns away, asking if Four knows then. Four extends his great arm forward, shoving it towards Metius, who ignores it, and Four says that he does, weakly asking him why. As a single small pebble falls above Four's head, his protective bubble activates, eliminating it before it can hit him. Metius notices this and sighs, touching the ground below him and muttering something to himself. He asks, why does he think he's doing what he's doing, calling Four a hypocrite? Out of all the people in the world, has he not considered how ironic it is that he is the one asking that question? He tries to reach for Four, but his movement once again touches the ground, and he states that he's doing what needs to be done to be remembered as something more than the brother of a man that did nothing. He then practically runs over to the other side of the balcony, much to Four's confusion, and says that Fomet was no more than a coward, a figure who wanted all the praise for none of the work. He could never put any actual effort into anything he did, unable to sacrifice anything but his time for the position the people put him in. He stagnated in his wisdom, thinking putting someone in check was the same as checkmate. He could not force himself to make the right decision, deciding that the sacrifice of a few human magicians was a price not worth paying to undo the stagnation of their kind, when he knew that they would overthrow them eventually anyways. But Metius is everything but a coward. Fomet would have forgiven them, let them choose to bring the Yeren back in, but he doesn't ask. He takes what rightfully belongs to his people, no matter the cost. Four asks if that justifies turning himself into a harbinger of genocide, as he'll kill literal millions of humans. He treats them like batteries, like they're not even people, just because the magic within them can fuel his ritual. He calls him a lunatic, if he really believes that murdering all human mages is worth breaking his damn curse. Metius replies that maybe he is one, but that still makes him more worthy of his position than Fomet, or Four. He then coughs 3 times into his palm before patting himself on the head, and if Four wasn't so angry, he would have raised an eyebrow. Metius asks what even gives him the right to judge him, as he doesn't know what it feels like to have history forget how he saved literal billions because his brother is some sort of idiot thinker. He doesn't realize what it feels like when his unfathomable achievements are entirely forgotten because some stupid flip of a coin decided that he would be raised under the same roof as an idiot who would become a foolish, ironic messiah, despite doing next to nothing to even match his accomplishments. Metius closes his eyes and walks to the other side of the gallery, spitting on the ground and inhaling. He tells Four that he has decided that if history will not be kind to him, neither will he be to history. He simply does what must be done to truly care for his people, and he is willing and ready to pay the necessary price to free them from their curse, to free them as they truly deserve. He says that Four was wrong about his people dying in the dark, as they wouldn't do so if it meant others may yet live in the light. Four will die in the light so that the Yeren can live in the dark. Four backs off, shaking his head, before pointing at the red circle around Metius' right hand, signifying their death oath. Metius, in response, simply shakes his arm, breaking apart the runes, asking if he really thought his parlor tricks would work against a magical force of nature like himself. Four calls him psychopathic and asks why he's even telling him this. Does he need someone to throw his unhinged ambition at before he turns and smiles to the people down there, telling them that he did the good thing? Metius simply smirks and says no. He just needed to get Four's attention away from his hands for a second. He then extends his hand upward, and red lightning starts to crackle along his fingers. The irregular points he previously walked towards explode with magical energy that surges towards his palm, extending into a translucent bubble that surrounds their entire figure. It eventually forms into an opaque cocoon around Metius, that immediately starts to crack from the impact of the lightning. Four looks at it, terrified, and attempts to run away, but as he tries to once more activate the balcony's entrance, a blast of energy sends him flying into the air. His back cracks against the bricks of the balcony, but he doesn't take any physical damage due to his protective bubble. He looks again to the transformation site, which is now cracking at an exponentially increasing rate, before the cocoon suddenly bursts with a blinding red light that fades moments later. When Four can see again, Metius is gone, instead replaced by a 50-meter-tall figure that looks identical to him. The giant smiles, cackling loudly, and draws his sword. Four tries to turn away, but Metius swings the sword down, now crackling with pure magic energy. Four braces for the impact, but seconds later, he opens his eyes again and sees that he's surrounded by huge plumes of dust and smoke. The sound of loud cracks of stone meeting flesh can be heard, accompanied by feminine grunts and Metius's screams. As Four finally emerges from the immense cloud of dust and smoke, he hears Metius shout in anger before seeing him with a 100-meter-tall stone statue clutching to his waist while bashing his head with a large glowing lantern. The statue is one of the ones that had been on the bank of the lava lake, and it proceeds to pick up Metius and throw him against the beacon tower, with a resounding crash that shakes the entire structure. Amidst the ruins of the palace, Yeren begin to pour from the collapsing structure in an attempt to attack the king, who deflects their assault with ease. The statue turns directly towards Four while panting, shouting that she could really use a hand here. The statue's face opens up, revealing a levitating 058 within, her eyes burning with a bright purple light that fills the entirety of the head. From her appendages, violet, rope-like structures formed from her reality-bending powers connect her body to arms and legs of the Colossus. The protesting Yeren start to cheer, and she looks at Four, nodding to him to come closer, but he simply blinks, unable to move. She calls him hopeless and uses her powers to cause him to levitate towards her, eventually bringing him into the statue's head, which closes behind him. In the distance, Metius starts to move again, opening his eyes, and he furiously starts to move his hands in a fluent manner, weaving a spell as reality crackles and bends around him. Eight notices and smiles widely, punching his jaw with an uppercut and sending him flying into the air. Rather than crashing back down, though, he manages to form a pane of ice-like material between his legs, which flows down towards his adversary, creating a frozen bridge. Eight attempts to crush it with her left hand, while attempting to maneuver into a proper striking position with her right. As she attempts to strike him, however, he draws a sword that destroys the hand, turning the air around it into steam. Eight shouts, turning suddenly and striking the now laughing Metius in the back of the head. He stumbles and tries to lash out with his blade, with the sword breaking in half upon making contact with the head of the statue. Both Metius and the broken blade crash to the ground, forming a crater below them. Four is still bewildered as 058 charges the statue towards Metius, leaping above him and extending her elbow towards his face. Metius attempts to position his legs to impede the strike, but the onslaught of Yeren around him prevents one leg from raising. He kicks the statue with the other, forcing her into the air as he jumps to meet her halfway. He clenches his fist and punches towards her face, which she only partially stops, sending her back into the air. As she does so, though, she grabs the king's own wrist and pulls him into her, forcing both to crash into the ceiling, both of them sustaining damage as they enter a free fall towards the palace's beacon spire. Before the statue crashes into the spire, Eight turns to Four and says that she was in the area, and it's hard not to know what your brother is up to when you're a telepath. She does still care about him, in case he hasn't noticed yet, and the rest of the council are notified of the situation. Before Four can express anger, the two feel their bodies levitate upwards, carried by the white beacon. Both Metius and Eight grunt in pain as the beacon begins to suck the magic from their bodies, seeming to grow stronger in the process and further increasing the magic drain. Color begins to fade from Eight's eyes, causing Four to exclaim and begin slapping her to try and wake her up. Her body begins to visibly wither, growing grayer and grayer, while Metius is still conscious despite the beacon continuing to shrink his body. Although he appears nearly incapable of locomotion due to the exhaustion resulting from the transformative ritual, he manages to kick himself free from the now inanimate Colossus, freeing himself and the Overseers both from the beacon as it continues to climb up. Both crash down into the palace below, shattering the face of the statue, while Metius manages to stand and slowly march towards it, while grabbing his bleeding right arm. A highly glitched voice comes through Four's personal camera, and he taps it several times, asking Command if they can hear him. Command's voice comes in and out, as Four looks frantically between the camera, Metius, and his unconscious sister. He tells Command to redirect him to 057, as Metius picks up the pace towards them. Seven comes over the communicator, and Four shouts for her to fire any Eigen weapons they have at them. Seven replies that all they have is Hecor, the high-energy concentration orbital railgun, which fires a beam of energy rivaling 10 atomic detonations, capable of evaporating anything within a 2-kilometer radius of the designated target. She groans and says that she can't compromise the life of two overseers, but Four shouts his override code and swears at her to fire it, so she does. Metius nearly reaches the two when he suddenly stops, looking upward through squinting eyes, before the feed stops for 20 seconds. When the feed reestablishes, the grotto in which they were resting is 10 times larger, and the sky above is blindingly yellow. Eight is standing once more, actively attempting to bend Hecor's energy beam towards Metius, who is similarly attempting to gain control over it. Despite their relative influence over it, its energy continues to excavate more and more of the surrounding area. Both of them pant heavily, clinging to consciousness, but they remain in a deadlock regardless, eyeing each other with pure desperation. Between them, the ritual beacon continues to tear its way up towards the surface as it begins to pulsate frequently. Suddenly, the thaumaturgic light meets with Hekor's energy, and everything goes infinitely bright. 2 seconds later, both Eight and Metius are thrown against opposite walls as the energy beam goes haywire and starts to bend, frantically moving around the cavern and damaging everything around it. It almost touches Eight, but Four tackles her out of the way as the beacon rebounds off the wall and hits the ceiling above Metius, forcing rubble to nearly bury him. He appears unable to move as Hekor's fire meets the thaumaturgic energy once again. This time, the rebound makes the eigenweapon go sideways, cutting a diagonal line up the surface before suddenly stopping, finishing its attack. The beacon, however, still persists, escaping into the above ground, piercing the sky and the grotto in which the three are trapped. Everything slowly quiets down, with Four laying unconscious and Eight standing above him, barely conscious herself. In the distance, Metius lays half buried underneath stones, with only his right arm and bleeding head visible. He reaches outwards, shouting that this isn't over, as the ceiling collapses above them. Eight manages to protect herself and Four, but Metius isn't so lucky, with a large rock splitting open his skull. The rest of the rock slide carries his body into the hole within which the sundown ritual beacon is still shining. As soon as his corpse touches the beam, it starts to burn with blinding intensity, forcing the carcass to become gray within an instant. Its yellow light turns into pure, iridescent blue, and the pillar fully shoots into the sky, terminating upon reaching the cosmos. In that very point in space, an illusion similar to the facsimile of the universe located within Metius' inner sanctum appears. The beacon branches out into every star, every planet, and every galaxy visible within it, forming a structure reminiscent of a tree. Through it, energy pulsates, and it reaches each celestial body at a rapid pace, making them glow with pure power. Then they all explode, one by one, shattering into a billion small glass-like pieces that float down like snow, slowly sinking to the ground as the ritual beacon fades. For a moment, the entire world is silent before a cacophony of hundreds upon thousands of Yeren voices, seemingly coming from everywhere and nowhere, cheer from above and below. Soon they too fall silent, and as the scene concludes, Eight looks around herself, smirking through near death. She gazes at Four, smiling sadly, and sits down next to him. She says that for what it's worth, she's so sorry, before passing out. Following the retrieval of both overseers after the incident, they were both immediately hospitalized within Site-01's medical ward. Due to her ontokinetic abilities, Eight was able to recover much more quickly than Four, who remained in bed for a couple of weeks. When he finally awoke, Eight was standing next to him, yawning loudly, telling him that it took him long enough. He smiles faintly, and she asks if they're even now, as he saved her and she saved him, twice. Four chuckles and agrees, but says that there are better ways for her to show affection than shouting at him in council meetings, especially if she's trying to convince him to do something. She throws her hands in the air theatrically, and the two look at each other for a moment before Eight sits, asking him how he's holding up. He replies that they patched him up all right, although they wanted to ship him over to Medical Site 12 to receive cleric radiation, but he preferred to stay somewhere he can actually talk about what happened down there. Eight says that that's actually why she's here, aside from visiting him, and she conjures up a tablet, asking if he remembers everything. Four replies that they pumped him with enough Nestics to kill a grown horse, so yeah, he remembers everything up until he passed out. He asks if she got him, and if everyone is safe, to which she grins and says that she took care of him. They've yet to see any of them fly out into orbit, but she's pretty sure that what she saw down there means that Metius needed an extremely strong magical catalyst to finish the ritual, and his body was more than plenty. Four sighs with relief and asks about 7600. Eight tells him that 051 took over the project after she quit, and made some pact with the new rulers, putting Project Anhui into progress worldwide to make the global population forget. He said that he'll make sure to help them find a place in the paranormal world above while they continue to analyze their technology, hopefully allowing them to utilize it in further projects. Four begins to protest, but Eight says that he doesn't really have a say in 7600 anymore, and neither does she, by her own request. She has something infinitely more interesting and important for him, and hands over the tablet, which plays a recording. The recording shows the events of the incident, allowing him to see what occurred after he passed out, but he's not sure what she wanted him to see. She replays the video, specifically showing the part where Metius was killed by a falling stone, and says that it's a little suspicious that someone as powerful as him got killed by a rock, seemingly on pure bad luck. Four shrugs, saying that it was hectic down there, but she calls him hopeless. She put it through anti-mimetics, unreality, and spectral affairs, and got something else out of it. A different video showing the same scene reveals that moments before Metius dies, a spectral figure, reminiscent of a white-furred Yeren propped up against a cane, manifests from thin air. It looks directly into the camera, slowly nods, and proceeds to move its hand, at which point the rock hits Metius's head. The figure looks into the recording device again, this time with regret in its eyes, and jumps upward into the opening formed by Hekor's activation. Eight says that everything lines up, from appearance to mannerisms, and they're 99% sure that that is Fomet. That's not all, though, and as Metius's corpse powers up the ritual and the cosmos scenery explodes around Eight, a loud screech full of hatred can be heard. With each chain being broken and each star becoming reachable, one more piece of another ghostly entity forms next to Fomet with the scream of 1,000 dying souls. Eventually, they compile together into a feminine fey figure with long silver hair and a crown of silver ice above her head. The figure tries to reach for Fomet's face with her claw-like fingers, only for the Yeren to easily repel her with a few moves of his hands. Above his head, for a split second, the face of another fey, similar in appearance to the other, but with a crown formed from summer grass and branches, can be seen. They clash like this until Eight passes out, at which point the recording ends. Four blinks twice, stating that he genuinely cannot begin to describe how much this changes, and Eight agrees. After a brief pause, Four says that he hates to say it, but there's only one way to go about this. Eight asks if he's thinking what she's thinking, to which he nods and grins, and replies that it's high time they came home. Alright, so to summarize everything, many thousands of years ago, when Queen Mab of the Fey convinced humanity to overthrow the Yeren to become the dominant species, Metius managed to save millions of their lives by taking them deep underground and managing their construction of Druv Tul. The Yeren have, in a sense, prospered under his rule, with Druv Tul being a marvel beyond comprehension, housing 2 billion of their species. Unfortunately, Mab, before she died, cursed the Yeren, sapping them of their dreams and forcing them to be little more than mindless laborers. This especially irks Metius, who has always yearned to go beyond the Earth and to reach the stars, so he hoped to find a way to free them from their curse. His brother, Fomet, is worshipped as a god by the Yeren due to his great wisdom, and he knew of a way to free them of the curse, but felt that the price was too high to pay. When Metius still insisted on striving for the stars, Fomet left this reality, seeking out more wisdom in the hopes of continuing to guide his people. The sundown ritual has been the Yeren's great work for thousands of years, with the goal of creating a beacon bright enough to pierce through realities and guide Fomet home so that he may once again share his great wisdom. 054, enraptured with Druv'tul and delighted with Metius' civility and aspirations, agrees to help in any way he can to see the ritual completed. As it turns out, however, while Metius does wish to free his people from the curse, he has an ulterior motive for the ritual, as he has perpetually been living in his brother's shadow. He learned the price that it would take to free them, with the price being the ritual sacrifice of every human thaumaturge on Earth. While that might be a drop in the bucket for the Emperor of Mankind, 054 and 8 don't take kindly to it, leading to the massive, kaiju-esque battle in the Inner Sanctum. While Metius appears to die at the end from random chance, it's shown that Fomet is not so far removed from this reality as they thought, and he made the rock fall that crushed his brother's skull. It's then revealed that Queen Mab is still alive in some form, furious that her curse has been undone, and her sister is still present as well to oppose her alongside Fomet. Yes, it's a bit of a deus ex machina, with 4 and 8 being saved by, essentially, chance, but this article was an entry for the SCP-7000 contest, of which the theme was luck. The conclusion of the article links to SCP-8120, Bloodbound, in which the two siblings seek out a way to kill Queen Mab once and for all. That one will have to wait for another time, however. With billions of Yeren now free from the curse thanks to Metius' incidental sacrifice, it will be interesting to see if the various factions can learn from past mistakes, or just repeat old history.